This is the first Sunday of the month, and we'll be taking steps 1 and 2 with Brian and Catherine.
Welcome to the Beginner's Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous Group. In this Big Book 12-step meeting, we follow the directions in the Big Book and take all 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1 month. We take the 12 steps at the group level as an overview. If you want to take the 12 steps on a one-to-one basis, please connect with a sharing partner after the meeting ends tonight. A sharing partner is someone who has taken all 12 steps and has had a spiritual awakening and is willing to help the new person through the 12 steps. We are recreating the beginner's classes in the early 1940s when recovery from alcoholism was over 75%. In Cleveland, there were 4 beginner's classes with a 93% sobriety rate. Our AA pioneers took 12 steps fast. Beginner's Big Book provides sharing partners for this meeting only. They can work with you on a one-to-one basis to take all 12 steps and be recovered from alcoholism. Any men or women who want to take the 12 steps, please connect with a sharing partner after the meeting ends. Will the sharing partners who want to work with others please raise your hand? Thank you. We have Big Book study guidebooks available to use in the meeting. Each page and paragraph is numbered. Please do not write in the book. Big Book study guidebooks are for sale at group cost of $8. Please silence your cell phones and please no texting.
All court papers will be signed after the meeting is over, after we have said the Lord's Prayer. Please keep your court paper until then. Sometimes this meeting runs over 1 hour. Do not expect to have your court paper signed at 7:30 or if you have to leave early. Again, all court papers will be signed after we had said the Lord's Prayer. Please keep your court paper until then, and we'll sign it after the meeting is over.
This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses or opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Here's a quote from our AA co-founder, Bill Wilson, written in the 1958 AA Grapevine. Sobriety, freedom from alcohol, through the teaching and practice of the 12 steps, is the sole purpose of an AA group. End quote. Let's have a moment of quiet time to invite the God of our own understanding into our hearts and remind ourselves why we are here tonight, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. We'll be passing the basket at this time for the seventh tradition.
We're going to open our meeting with a quiet time and follow it with the set-aside prayer. God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, the 12 steps, the big book, the meetings, my disease, and you, God, so I may have an open mind and a new experience with all these things. Please let me see the truth. Amen. Thank you. The big book, or the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that's nicknamed the Big Book, was first published in April 1939. Now, back then, we were a society of readers. Radios were still new, and if you wanted to see a movie, you had to go to your local theater. Now, of course, we have many kinds of home and portable entertainment available. Consequently, many of us don't read as much as we used to, so we can't expect everyone who comes to AA to read our book without some prompting, like maybe poke them with a sharp stick. But today, we're going to read a lot from our basic text. Reading the Big Book is the only way to learn from it. We hope that today's experience will encourage you to visit these pages often. You might want to think of the Big Book as your best friend. We're going to start by reading the foreword to the first edition at the top of Roman numeral page 13, XIII. It's the first paragraph.
Forward to the first edition. Yeah.
It's forward to the first edition, first page. It says, "We of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. For them, we hope that these pages will prove so convincing that no further authentication will be necessary."
So the Big Book authors immediately tell us that the main purpose of this book is to show others precisely how we have recovered from alcoholism. Precisely means no variation or deviation. No room for opinion here. Now, this is a revolutionary statement because before the Big Book was written, there was no hope for alcoholics. Now, anyone who is willing to follow the directions they have provided can recover. Now we're going to read the original preamble as it appeared back then, and this starts with the last line of the same page.
"We are not an organization in the conventional sense of the word. There are no fees or dues whatsoever. The only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. We are not allied with any particular faith, sect, or denomination, nor do we oppose anyone. We simply wish to be helpful to those who are afflicted."
Okay, let's begin our spiritual journey. Step one.
"We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable."
Surrender is essential in order to recover from alcoholism. The Big Book authors devote 51 pages of the book to the first part of the surrender process, which is to admit that we have a problem. Before we can do this, we need to define what an alcoholic is. Now, much of the doctor's opinion is based on two letters written by Dr. William Silkworth, who had been a physician at Towns Hospital in New York City. He had been treating alcoholics for years with very little success, until a miraculous fellowship was born. In the late 1930s, very little was known about alcoholism, but much of what the doctor wrote then is still relevant today.
Go to page XXIII in the third paragraph, XXIII, third paragraph, and it starts with, "In late 1934.
He describes how Bill W. recovered from alcoholism. Bill had once been a well-respected Wall Street stock analyst, but he eventually lost everything because of his drinking.
It says, In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of type I come to regard as hopeless. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were of this type with whom other methods had failed completely.
Then during his third trip to the hospital, Bill is told that alcoholism is a physical and a mental illness. Dr. Silkworth explains this to us now in the second paragraph on the following page.
Turn the page to XXIV, XXIV, first paragraph.
The physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms that we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as the mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted in life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were too, in some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent, with some of us, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete.
I always thought it would be amusing to have a T-shirt that says outright mental defective on it. Maybe the other side saying, in full flight from reality. Another way we can find each other, huh? Okay.
I'm going to read the next paragraph. It says, the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that this explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account.
Now let's look at this abnormal physical response to alcohol. Alcohol is a poison. The normal reaction to alcohol is to have one or two drinks and stop. But the alcoholic reaction is much different, obviously. We have one or two drinks just to get started. Can anyone relate to that? Yeah. Okay, so we have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. Now, Dr. Silkworth tells us that the average temperate drinker, a normal person, does not crave alcohol.
Go to page XXVI, XXVI, first paragraph.
It's the first paragraph. It says, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all, and once having formed a habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, and their problems pile up upon them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
So we have a physical allergy to alcohol and a craving for alcohol once we start drinking. This craving never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Normal people don't crave alcohol and they don't have an obsession with it. Now please keep in mind that Dr. Silkworth now is talking about alcoholics when he writes this in the last paragraph on the same page.
It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience a sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, which they seem others taken with impunity. After they had succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops, and they pass through well-known stages of esprit, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. Unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery.
We learn more about this phenomenon of craving in the last paragraph on the same page.
It says, I do not hold with those who believe that alcoholism is entirely a problem of mental control. I have had many men who had, for example, worked a period of months on some problem or business deal which was to be settled on a certain date favorable to them. They took a drink a day or so prior to the date and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests, so that the important appointment was not met. These men were not drinking to escape. They were drinking to overcome a craving beyond their mental control. There are many situations which arise out of the phenomenon of craving which cause men to make supreme sacrifice rather than continue to fight.
Which means they drink again. Now move down 4 paragraphs and we'll read more about this craving.
All these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be a manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity, and has never been by any treatment with which we are familiar permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence.
When I first went to a counselor and she suggested complete abstinence, I said to her, I thought that was rather extreme. So once we start to drink, we have a craving beyond our mental control. Our only relief is to not pick up the first drink. Let's go now to regular page 3 in chapter 1, starting with the second paragraph. We're going to read parts of Bill's story to help you identify with the progressive nature of alcoholism. That's regular page 3, chapter 1, the second paragraph.
It said, my drinking assumed more serious proportions, continuing all day and almost every night. The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row, and I became a lone wolf. There was many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment.
On page 5, paragraph 1, Bill writes,
and we're just going to read that one line on that page. It says, liquor ceased to be a luxury, it became a necessity.
So we crossed what we call that invisible line. Now drop down 8 lines.
It starts off with, nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation, and there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Gradually, things got worse.
Okay, please skip down a paragraph and read now about how frightened Bill was becoming.
I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed this time I meant business, so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. Hadn't even crossed my mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way. I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed. Confidence began to be replaced with cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. The remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity.
Now go to the next paragraph.
The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. For mind endured this agony 2 more years.
Let's go down 2 paragraphs, and we're going to learn about 3 different types of drinkers. Oops, wrong page. Oops, yeah. On the next page, count 3 lines down from the top. They stuck together.
3 lines down from the top of the page, it says, people feared for my sanity, so did I. It's the 3rd line down on page 7.
Now go to the 2nd paragraph.
It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly, and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge. But it was not. For the frightful day came when I drank once more. The curve of my declining morale and bodily health fell off like a ski jump. After a time, I returned to the hospital.
Okay, things are progressing quickly now. Now, in the first paragraph on page 8, Bill loses all hope. First paragraph.
No words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in the bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master.
Can anyone identify with the... All right. He's stopping me again. We do this on occasion. All right. I know that every time I read this, I feel... I get that feeling all over again, that horrible, terrible feeling that I felt when I first came in here, where I was afraid to live and I was afraid to die. I just didn't know which way to turn. Can anybody else identify then with the progression and hopelessness of Bill's alcoholism? Let's see. Oh, okay. Yeah, good. Now we're going to continue with Bill's story a little bit later. We're going to go into chapter 2, There is a Solution, starting on page 17. Now here we're given some hope. We're going from feeling hopeless, we want to get some hope. And we're going to find that in the first paragraph on page 17.
It says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem.
On the next page, the authors tell us how alcoholism destroys our lives and harms all those whose lives we touch. You know, people talk about, I wasn't hurting anybody but myself. Well, that's rubbish.
It says, an illness of this sort, we have come to believe it an illness, involves those about us in a way no human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt, but not so with the alcoholic illness. For with it goes annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. It engulfs all those lives touched the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. We hope this volume will inform and comfort those who are or who may be affected. There are many.
Please skip down to the fourth paragraph. Here the authors use squiggly writing to let us know it's really important. Every time we see that squiggly writing, pay attention.
It says, but the ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, who is properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished.
Starting with the first paragraph on page 20, we're given the purpose of this book.
First paragraph, page 20. You may already have asked yourself, why is it that all of us become so very ill from drinking? Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you are an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically.
Let's go down two paragraphs, and there we find we're going to learn about the three different types of drinkers. Now we're going to learn about them. Okay.
It says...
We're going to go to two paragraphs down and learn about the three different types of alcoholics. Two different types of drinkers, I mean.
Page 20.
It's page 20.
Starts off with the moderate drinker. Moderate drinkers have little trouble in giving up liquor entirely if they had good reason for it. They can take it or leave it alone. Then we have a certain type of hard drinker who may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair him physically and mentally and may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficient strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, or a warning of a doctor becomes operative, this man can also stop or moderate, although he may find it difficult and troublesome, may even need medical attention. But what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker. He may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. But at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts to drink.
So the question is, what happens to the real alcoholic after he takes the first drink? Anybody know?
Another drink.
That's it. More and more. Okay, in the last paragraph on the bottom of page 22, we learn where the main problem of the alcoholic centers.
We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for months or years, he reacts much like other men. We are equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. These observations would be academic and pointless if our friend never took the first drink, thereby setting the cycle in motion. Therefore, the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. If you ask him why he started on the last bender, the chances are he will offer you any one of 100 alibis.
Next, we learn more about the mental obsession in the following paragraph.
Once in a while, he may tell the truth. And the truth, strange to say, is usually he has no more idea why he took the first drink than you have. Some drinkers have excuses with which they are satisfied part of the time, but in their hearts, they really do not know why they do that. Once this malady has a real hold, they are baffled a lot. There is an obsession that somehow, someday, they will beat the game, but they often suspect that they are down for the count. How true this is, few realize in a vague way their families and friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal. But everybody hopefully awaits today when the sufferer arouses himself from his lethargy and exerts his willpower. The tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. The tragic situation has already arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. Now we're going to go to the squiggly writing. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscured, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink.
Okay, there's that squiggly writing. Let's read that last line again. It's very important.
We are without defense against that first drink.
Now let's continue down the page.
The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazily and readily supplanted with the old, threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of a kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. The alcoholic may say to himself in the most casual way, "It won't hurt me this time, so here's how." Or perhaps he doesn't think at all. How often have some of us begun to drink in this nonchalant way, and after the third or fourth, pounded on the bar and said to ourselves, "For God's sakes, how did I ever get started again?" Only to have that thought supplanted by, "Well, I'll stop with the sixth drink, or what's the use anyhow?" When this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, he has probably placed himself beyond human aid, and unless locked up, may die or go permanently insane. These stark and ugly facts have been confirmed by legions of alcoholics throughout history.
There's some very harsh words there. May die or permanently go insane. Now on page 30, six pages forward, in paragraph 1, we read about how we will never again control our drinking. Page 30, paragraph 1.
Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death.
Now skip down one paragraph.
We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better.
In the next paragraph, we're told that we can never become normal drinkers once we have lost control. Once a pickle, always a pickle. No matter how hard I try, I can never be a cucumber again.
We are like men who lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there was brief recovery, followed always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic.
The authors clearly state that relapse is not part of the recovery program. Now let's read the next paragraph.
Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe that they are in this class. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exception to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats go off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people.
That one's ours, right? Please turn back to page 30. Sorry, this wasn't written in order, you know, but this is the best we can do. All right, back to page 30 in the second paragraph. Here we're told what we have to do for step one.
It says, we learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or present it may be, has to be smashed.
In order to smash the delusion that you're not alcoholic, we're going to ask each of you to answer a simple question. Are you ready to concede to your innermost self that you are powerless over alcohol? In other words, are you an alcoholic? All that is required is a simple yes or no. Now, maybe you don't believe that you're an alcoholic. Maybe you think you're here by mistake. We just want you to know we'd rather be inside the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous by mistake than outside the fellowship drinking and dying by mistake. It's something to think about. Now, will those who are ready to take the first step, please stand. We're going to stand up and we're going to do this. I want to try to make eye contact with each person, so I'm going to do it by table, you know, table by table. And I'm going to ask the question, and simply you can just answer yes or no and then be seated. And I'll ask the next person and go around the table till we've gone through the room. Now, here is our first step question. Do you concede to your innermost self that you are alcoholic? I'm going to start on my left.
Yes.
Okay, here? Okay, thank you. Good. Thank you. Okay. Okay. Here? Here? Okay. All right, we'll do here. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Yes. All right. There. Thank you. Congratulations. According to the Big Book authors, those who've answered yes to this question have taken step one. You've now started on the path to recovery. Please give yourself a hand. Now, step two.
Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity.
Now that we've admitted we are powerless, let's see what we have to do to become empowered. That sounds pretty appealing, doesn't it? It does to me. Okay, one day Bill W. was sitting in his kitchen drinking, as usual, when he gets a call from an old high school friend. Anyone know who that is? That's right, Ebby T. Now let's pick up the story on page 8. We're going to go back to Bill's story. Go to the fourth paragraph on page 8. I'm going to be Bill here. Switch roles here for a moment. Okay. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old high school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he'd been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course, he would have dinner, and then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. Now we'll read the next paragraph. The door opened, and he stood there, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had gotten into the fellow. He wasn't himself. "Come, what's all this about?" I queried. He looked straight at me simply, but smilingly he said,
"I've got religion."
I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yes, the old boy was on fire, all right. But bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. Boy, didn't you hate that when people were going to preach at you and you're thinking, oh, God, just leave so I can drink some more. But he did know ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, persuaded the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass his experience along to me, if I cared to have it. I was shocked, but interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless.
Going to go to page 11, the next page, and go to the third paragraph.
But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known.
Move down to the last line on the same page.
I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil.
Ebby tells Bill his life has been transformed as a result of practicing 4 spiritual activities, which are surrender, sharing, restitution, and guidance. And we're going to continue down page 12.
Continue down page 12. To come closer next time. Okay. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway may be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way.
Then Ebby presents Bill with a revolutionary proposition.
My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said,
"Why don't you choose your own conception of God?"
That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw that growth could start from this point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Bill's spiritual journey begins when he becomes willing to believe. We learn that we have only two alternatives on the third paragraph now on page 25. Third paragraph on page 25.
It says, if you are seriously alcoholic as we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible. And if we had passed into the region from which there was no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other to accept spiritual help. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort.
Now let's turn to page 43 and read the third paragraph. Page 43, third paragraph. Once more,
the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases. Neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
On the next page, page 44, we'll read the whole first paragraph again. We're going to 44 again.
It says, in the preceding chapters, you have learned something of alcoholism. We hope we've made a clear distinction between alcoholic and non-alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control of the amount you take, you are probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer.
To make sure everyone understands what we just read, we're going to read that last line again.
If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer.
We must have a spiritual transformation of heart and attitude toward life if we want to recover from alcoholism. You may be inclined to resist this as a solution to this fatal illness. Prior to AA, most alcoholics either died drunk or were locked up in jail or insane asylums. Most women had rather be considered crazy than to be shamefully labeled as alcoholic, and even worse, a drunken mother. Now let's go to the next paragraph on page 44.
To one who feels he is an atheist or agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he is the alcoholic of a hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face.
It occurred to me one day when I was reading this that if the non-alcoholic person, you're walking down the street and you ask the non-alcoholic person, the average person walking by, whether they'd rather die a horrible, lonely death or live a joyful spiritual way of life, it's not a tough choice for them. However, it seems to be a tough choice for us. Now, in the next paragraph, we're told no matter what our present beliefs, there's still hope for us.
There is hope. But it isn't so difficult. About half of our original fellowship were of exactly that type. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. Perhaps it is going to be that way with you. But cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostic. Our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed us utterly.
They failed us utterly. Now, we find it amazing that we can start the AA program without any specific belief, or for that matter, without any beliefs whatsoever. All a person needs is the willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness to believe that we believe this program works. Now, let us assure you, we do believe. Now let's see what we can learn about this spiritual solution. In the next paragraph, the author states,
lack of power. That was a dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live. and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. That means we have written a book which we believe to be spiritual as well as moral, and it means, of course, that we're going to talk about God. Here, difficulty arises with agnostics. Many times we talk to a new man and watch his hope rise as we discuss his alcoholic problems and explain our fellowship. But his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God, for we have reopened a subject which our man thought he had neatly evaded or entirely ignored. We know how he feels. We have shared his honest doubt and prejudice.
Now, I've heard that a spiritual piece of literature is one that where every time you read it, every time, you continue to receive more guidance and inspiration. You notice that every time you read the book, no matter how many times you say, hey, I don't remember that. It's amazing. It just keeps giving and giving to us. And then, of course, moral. We're talking about this book as being moral. And moral simply means knowing the difference between right and wrong. It's that simple. Okay, now we're going to go to the next page, where we'll look at how the big book authors describe God. They ask us to set aside any contempt we might have for spiritual principles and consider our own conception of God. If we do, we're going to be in a much better position to understand the AA solution for the alcoholic problem. Now let's start with the first paragraph.
It says, yes, we of agnostic temperament have had these thoughts and experiences. Let us make haste to reassure you. We found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power, which is God.
The big book authors clearly state that it is impossible to define God. So we have to stop trying to comprehend God with our minds. Remember, our thinking isn't very good. We have to stop trying to comprehend God with our minds and start accepting God with our hearts. That's why they call it a leap of faith. Now, in the next paragraph, we're asked to find a higher power of our own understanding.
Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach to effect a contact with him. As soon as we admitted the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we began to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction. Some promises in there. Provided we took other simple steps, we found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It is open, we believe, to all men.
So many of us found that our faith deepens and expands as time goes by. You know, I know if I waited for myself to have a clear understanding of what my higher power was, I may never have continued on with the fourth step, etc. You know, I found that everybody that sticks around here finds that their faith evolves. It's a natural thing that it evolves. This is about growing spiritually. We don't just get it before we can do the steps. It's something that happens over time. Now, we don't ask you that you believe just because we believe. We ask that you try it. This is a show me kind of a thing. You know, you do it and you'll find that it works. We found that it's always that way. And remember also, this is a program of attraction, and it works for everyone who tries it. Everyone who tries prayer honestly, it works. Now we find the directions for taking the second step in the second paragraph back on page 47, all the way back to 47, second paragraph.
Second paragraph on page 47. It says, we need to ask ourselves but one short question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? As soon as a man can say that he does believe, or is willing to believe, we emphatically assure him that he is on his way. It has been repeatedly proven among us that upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderful, effective spiritual structure can be built.
Okay, let's see who's ready to proceed. Will those who are willing to take step 2 please stand? Again, I'm going to make eye contact with you and go around the room. Here is our second step question. Do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than ourselves?
Absolutely.
I'm trying to get you. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
Yes. Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
Yes.
Yes,
I do.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes, I do. Yes. Yes, I do. Absolutely. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Now, according to the Big Book authors, those who answered yes to this question have taken step two. How about giving your neighbor a hand? Yeah.
Beginner's Big Book provides sharing partners for this meeting only. They can work with you on a one-to-one basis to take all 12 steps and be recovered from alcoholism. Any men or women who want to take the 12 steps, please connect with a sharing partner. Will the sharing partners who want to work with others please raise your hand? Thank you. In honor of our AA pioneers and the old tradition, we'll simply stand without holding hands and close this meeting with the Lord's Prayer.